doesn't mention to you that the ICC's decision applies to everyone in Palestine. This means that the ICC can also investigate Hamas and the Palestinian Authority if it chooses to do so. Reacting to this announcement, Germany and Hungary's foreign ministers also came out against the decision. The German foreign minister tweeted that the court has no jurisdiction because of the absence of the element of Palestinian statehood required by international law. This is extremely hypocritical because the entire international community, they say Palestine is not a state, they prevent Palestine from becoming a state, and then when Palestinians try to obtain justice, they give them no other avenue. This doesn't change the fact that Palestine has already acceded to the Rome Statute in 2015. The United States, which subsidizes the Israeli occupation to the tune of $3.8 billion a year in military aid, so that it can shoot unarmed Palestinians in the knees and murder them in aerial bombardments, also condemned this announcement by the ICC. Remember, Israel is the largest recipient of aid from the United States since World War II. Even as recently as December 2020, in the middle of a pandemic and economic crisis, with millions of Americans jobless and without health care, the United States still gave Israel $500 million. Now, on the flip side, Hamas and the Palestinian Authority actually welcomed the decision by the ICC, despite the fact that they could also face prosecution themselves. Many NGOs and human rights groups also welcomed this ruling by the ICC. Amnesty International, in particular, said that an ICC investigation marks a long overdue step towards justice for victims and is a chance to end the cycle of impunity that is at the heart of the human rights crisis in the occupied Palestinian territories. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Reacting to the news that the International Criminal Court at The Hague would be expanding its jurisdiction to include the Palestinian territories illegally occupied by Israel since 1967 is Michael Link. He is Associate Professor of Law at Western University in Ontario and also the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967. He said that, quote, the leading political organs of the United Nations have repeatedly failed to enforce their own significant body of resolutions on the Israeli occupation. This ruling opens the door for credible allegations of Rome Statute crimes to be finally investigated and potentially reach the trial stage at the ICC. He joins me now. Thanks for taking the time, Professor. It's good to have you on.
My pleasure to be here, Richard.
So, Professor, this decision by the ICC surrounding its jurisdiction in Palestine, it's received a lot of pushback from not just Israel, but Germany, Hungary, the United States. We've seen the Israeli embassies, they've been dispatching their ambassadors to put a lot of pressure on other countries to tell the ICC not to go ahead with this. Netanyahu was saying that the ICC is anti-Semitic. Danny Dunan, their permanent representative to the UN, was saying that Fatou Bensouda, the ICC chief prosecutor, should be indicted herself. So, I mean, what's your reaction to all this pushback from Israel and their allies?
Sure. It's, you know, the fundamental principle that every first-year law student learns in any law school around the world is the independence of the judiciary, that courts, once created and judges appointed, are to be independent of political influences and are to be able to make their decisions in full confidence that that their independence is going to be respected. That's the only way in which we build public trust in the operation of the courts and the rule of law. So ever since the ICC announced, or the prosecutor announced, that she was going to initiate investigations into the complaints coming to her office with respect to alleged war crimes, not only by Israel, but also by Palestinian armed groups as well, in Gaza and the West Bank and East Jerusalem, there has been a concerted pressure on the court. has reached its apex last year when the United States said it was going to ban the travel to the United States of any international criminal court officials. It's astounding to me in this modern day and age that the prosecutor and judges and staff of an independent international court would be under threat of arrest by a leading Western democracy, and the attention is not on the country or the groups who are alleged to have committed war crimes. This seems to have turned international criminal justice upside down.
And could you maybe tell us what are some of the consequences that Israeli officials or Palestinian officials could face if they're maybe charged or convicted? Because travel is obviously one of them. You know, they're afraid to travel to countries that are a party to the Rome Statute. What are some of the other obstacles or consequences they could face as a result of this?
Sure. One big one, obviously, is the fear of arrest. The practice of the court in other proceedings has to been to create, hidden indictments, which are then sent to all members of the state members of the International Criminal Court, and those indictments are sitting there waiting for a potential war criminal to come to their jurisdiction, by which they'd be arrested and then turned over to the ICC in The Hague. So that would be the concern of anybody who might have participated either in a military sense or in a political sense with respect to the commission of alleged war crimes. So the big impact will be on travel. Other impacts would be being arrested and then spending a long period of time as the guest of the ICC, either awaiting trial or, if convicted, then serving time in Dutch jails.
The scope of the ICC's ruling includes Operation Protective Edge in 2014, the right to return protests or marches in 2018, and the illegal settlements that Israel has been building. Do you feel that's an adequate purview, or do you feel that there were some other things that could have been included in there?
I don't think the file is closed as to what the prosecutor might look at, assuming everything begins going forward with respect to investigation. You've mentioned the three principal areas involving Israel, but I could imagine that there might be future complaints which may turn into allegations of a war crime with respect to apartheid, with respect to wars of aggression, with respect to crimes against humanity. So all those are part and parcel of what could happen, depending on where the prosecutor goes and what facts are revealed to him or to her.
Isn't there a glaring double standard going on here? Because, you know, the Israelis are arguing that Palestine can't be considered under ICC jurisdiction because it doesn't possess key elements of effective territorial control. What they're saying, essentially, is that it's not a real state, and that therefore the ICC can't say it has jurisdiction there. Yet, just a few weeks ago, we were hearing from the Israelis in terms of the COVID vaccine. They said, oh, well, the Palestinians are on their own. They can stand on their own 2 feet. They're in charge of their own health affairs. Isn't that a striking double standard there and hypocrisy?
There is a two-sided argument there where it has to do with obligations of the occupier toward the protected population under occupation. Everything is then shifted over to the responsibility of the Palestinian Authority. And where it has to do with other issues, there is a denial that exists a Palestinian state. Remember this, you know, the ruling issued on Friday was a relatively narrow ruling. It didn't say that Palestine constitutes a state with respect to all aspects of international law. It said that it constitutes a state and therefore has the legal personality to sign the Rome Treaty and be bound by it within the definition of a state party for the purposes of the Rome Statute. So it's a narrower definition than what some people have attributed to it. It's a technical definition saying that the PA has enough attributes of legal personality to be able to sign the Rome Statute. And so the cries with respect to some Western countries that Palestine is not a state, that's a separate issue that will come down the road for other issues. I think they're overblowing it. And when I hear that argument raised, including by my own government, it tells me that they can't be serious with respect to want to see, justice applied impartially throughout the world, wherever the Rome Statute would wind up applying.
So, if we're potentially going to see some charges brought, how long do you think that process would take? Are we talking about a few years here, a few decades? What is typically the case?
We're on a bit of unknown ground, but keep this in mind. The Palestinian Authority has signed the Rome Statute, I believe, in January 2015, 6 years ago. And it issued its initial complaints very shortly after that. So this has been before the court now for over 6 years, and we're only satisfying the end of the first of what are three stages: the preliminary investigation, the formal investigation, and then, if it passes that hurdle, then the trial. So there might be complications with respect to gathering evidence. Israel will not allow investigators to come to either Israel or the West Bank or East Jerusalem. So all that can be done, they could go through Egypt into Gaza to be able to gather some evidence. But I think we'd all acknowledge it's going to be complicated and time-consuming, and the prosecutor is going to have to be satisfied that the evidence that he or she has gathered is going to be able to stand up in court. You want your evidence to be as solid as possible. On the other hand, the allegation with respect to the settlements, my sense is that's coming close to being an open and closed legal question. The settlements have been illegal under international humanitarian law since the Fourth Geneva Convention was adopted over 70 years ago. That was strengthened by the 1977 Additional Protocol, and that was a centerpiece of the war crimes listed in the 1998 Rome Statute. Yes, there will have to be issues addressed as to if the settlements are a violation of the Rome Statute, which it'd be difficult for me to see why they wouldn't be found to be. Then who do you wind up identifying as the individuals to whom Rome Statute charges would be laid against? Because as we know, the Rome Statute identifies individuals, not states, as those who would be in the docket and those who would wind up being indicted. So there would be some effort have to identify the leading military or civilian or political leaders who played a significant part in the shaping of the settlements. And of course, the last issue would be the identification of leading political or military figures with respect to Palestinian armed groups to whom indictment may be flowing towards as well.
Again, the ICC is saying it's ready to investigate both sides, not just Israel. It hasn't even charged anyone with a crime yet. So it's quite astonishing to see so much pushback from this. To be frank,
to go to your point, this is one of the very few forms of modern, meaningful accountability that has arisen with respect to the 53-year-old unaccountable Israeli occupation. All of the hundreds of resolutions that have been adopted by the UN Security Council, the UN General Assembly, the UN Human Rights Council, among other leading UN bodies, there's been no steps taken with respect to any form of meaningful accountability with respect to Israel and its conduct of the occupation. Now, when Israel finally faces the prospect, still in the future, with respect to appearing in a docket to answer charges related to the Rome Statute, of course there is some worry, and I think that's justifiable worry. If the world had taken the issue of accountability seriously 40 years ago, 20 years ago, there wouldn't have been a need for an ICC process, because Israel would have been compelled by international pressure and international law to vacate its occupation and to allow full Palestinian self-determination on the Palestinian territory.
Thanks for your time, Professor. Again, great speaking with you.
My pleasure, Richard. Good luck with this.
The double standard displayed here by the Israelis is incredible, but not surprising, frankly. Once again, Israel claims that Palestine is not a real state and that therefore it cannot be placed under ICC jurisdiction. However, just a few weeks ago, when it came to Palestinians not having any sufficient doses of the COVID-19 vaccine, back then, Israel claimed that Palestine was responsible for its own jurisdiction. So once again, we see here the glaring hypocrisy of the Zionist regime. When it suits them, they're a democracy. They're the only democracy in the Middle East. But when it comes to actually holding military personnel and politicians accountable for possible war crimes, suddenly they're not interested in the pursuit of justice and accountability and checks and balances. And when it comes to the Palestinians being undervaccinated, not having access to the same public health facilities and infrastructure because their land is under occupation and they're constantly bombarded and murdered, Israel claims they're not standing in the way and Palestinians have self-determination. But when it comes to Palestinians actually seeking justice for the atrocities that they were submitted to, now Israel says they can't and speaks for them. This kind of impunity and how the Zionist occupation is able to get away with all these crimes is frankly astonishing. It's truly staggering. I mean, the statement by the ICC is not even a judgment or a ruling. It doesn't even charge anyone with a crime, let alone convict them. And even then, Israeli politicians, foreign leaders are up in arms as if it were the biggest affront on their person. The very prospect or notion that Israeli politicians and military leaders could face justice for carrying out war crimes and the most inhumane of acts is an insult to them. It's inconceivable in their view. This speaks to the derangement and the arrogance and the disconnect at play here. You can see how Israel is so used to oppressing the Palestinian people with impunity and getting away with it that this very idea that Palestinians could attain some sort of justice, some semblance of accountability, no matter how small, is perceived as an attack. But hopefully, we do see some justice, we do see some accountability, and that this changes. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The latest annual student data report from the Social Science Research Group, Jain Family Institute, published recently, belies claims by President Joe Biden, who said he would not cancel $50,000 in federal student loan debt per borrower, that such a move would disproportionately benefit people who attend elite private universities. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is published under the heading, New Economic Study Demolishes Myth About Student Debt Parroted by Joe Biden. Stay tuned for the details, please. the latest annual student debt report from the social science research group Jane Family Institute, published recently, belies claims by President Joe Biden, who said he would not cancel $50,000 in federal student loan debt per borrower, that such a move would disproportionately benefit people who attend elite private universities. The 2021 Student Debt and Young America report, authored by JFI's Laura Beamer and Edward Nielage, begins by noting that young people are overrun with student debt. This crisis is the culmination of waning government funding for higher education, wage stagnation, wealth inequality, and a misleading emphasis on obtaining high credentials, all leading to the financial gap between college prices and later earnings, they wrote. In 2020, aggregate balances reached $1.66 trillion in 2019 dollars, 122% higher in real dollars than in 2010. The authors continue. Not surprisingly, the number of borrowers, the amount they owe, and the number of loans each borrower acquires have all increased over the time period. In 2019, 18 to 35-year-olds with a student loan debt owed nearly $35,000 on average, compared to just over $28,000 in 2009. Back in 2009, there were only 32 million federal borrowers. In 2019, that number swelled to 43 million. The recent study notes marked racial disparities in student debt, with black people suffering both the largest increase over time and the highest median amount owed in 2019, at $20,236. Asian students experienced the worst debt inequality in 2019, although their median debt was $18,548 that year. Their average debt balance was $38,860. Critically, this study finds, because low and lower middle income communities see the worst debt to income ratios, they would see the largest portion of their income freed up throughout student debt forgiveness. Young adult borrowers in low and lower middle income communities would receive an outsized share of forgiveness in aggregate dollars compared to middle and upper income communities. This flies in the face of the implications of Biden's remarks at a CNN town hall in Milwaukee, where the president said he doesn't want to forgive billions of dollars of debt for people who have gone to Harvard and Yale and Penn, instead of using that money to provide money for early education for young children who come from disadvantaged circumstances. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, an outspoken proponent of student debt forgiveness, rebutted Biden's assertion by asking, who cares what school someone went to? Entire generations of working-class kids were encouraged to go into more debt under the guise of elitism. This is wrong, Ocasio-Cortez tweeted late recently. The case against student loan forgiveness is looking shakier by the day. We can and should do it. Keep pushing. Speaking of freshly published JFI study, Beamer recently tweeted that she was waiting until this report came out to address the ridiculous Harvard, Yale, and Penn comment from Biden, calling it a myth that borrowers attending elite schools would overwhelmingly benefit from forgiveness compared to their peers elsewhere. Thank you. other progressive politicians and advocates also pushed back on Biden's remarks. Representative Ayanna Pressley affirmed that the president could cancel student debt with the stroke of a pen. Americans for Financial Reform, which has led demands for Biden to cancel $50,000 of student debt per borrower through executive action, recently decried Biden's proposed $10,000 per person debt relief as inadequate. Far more than $10,000 in cancellation is required, the group said, to provide it that 44 million families and the economy need.
Around the World with Reporters.
Israeli forces opened the gates of its rainwater stores east of Gaza, allowing rainwater to flood large swaths of Palestinian land. The Palestinian Ministry of Agriculture said in a statement that the water drowned thousands of meters of agricultural lands and damaged wheat and other winter crops. This led to great financial losses for farmers.
Every year in this time, Israeli army opens the rainwater gates to flood our lands and destroy the crops. Israel also sprays harmful herbicides at our land, damaging all the farms and crops planted. These attempts aim at forcing us to leave this land. We stress that these attempts won't make us leave. We will remain here.
In violation of international standards, Israeli army also shoot at Palestinian farmers to push them off their lands and spray herbicides beside the buffer zone along the Gaza Strip, something directly affects the livelihood of Palestinians.
This is the second time in a month the Israeli army has opened its water gates and flooded our agricultural lands. All the winter crops are now destroyed here. This means a great financial loss for the farmers and even consumers. Our life as a farmer is under risk of being shot by Israeli army.
The Ministry of Agriculture says the move hampers transference of Gaza's main source of fruits and vegetables.
Over thousands of meters of our lands have been destroyed this time. Opening rainwater gates is a move by Israeli army to force us to leave our lands and damage the main food supply for Gaza. Drowning these crops would not only damage the planted crops, but also the lands.
Palestinians here say the living conditions have been deteriorating due to the Israeli blockade. They say Israel is now making the bad situation worse by damaging their agricultural lands and causing them financial losses. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
In the Rohingya refugee camp in the outskirts of New Delhi, there is an utter panic and the residents are fearful even going out to buy the essentials. They say many are chased, intimidated, and usually police and other agencies visit their camps to monitor their movements. Ali Johar, a young Rohingya refugee, says several have been arrested in the recent months and put into jails for illegally entering India, saying the whole community is in utter despair.
Around 60 people have been arrested in the different parts of India, including West Bengal, Manipur, Assam, Haryana, and Delhi. In Delhi, around 8 people were detained. In Haryana, several families were harassed to leave out from Haryana.
Fearful of possible arrest and expulsion, scores of refugees have gone into hiding across the Indian subcontinent, while others have entered Bangladesh amid a mounting hate campaign against the community in India. The destitute community, who has escaped what the United Nations described genocide, is struggling for existence amid international silence about their plight. An estimated 40,000 are living in India.
the community has faced a brutal crackdown by the army in their country, such as rape, murder, child killings, arbitrary arrests, forced disappearances, as well as destruction of the entire Rohingya villages. Now many fear that the military coup might make the situation even worse.
Some reports suggest hundreds of Rohingya are being held in Indian jails on charges of illegal entry and have no proper judicial support. Their men are unable to find work due to lack of identity cards and threats of intimidation by law enforcement agencies, forcing men to stay at their camps.
We have been living here peacefully since 2012. We came to save our lives, but the police and other agencies are usually coming to our camps for questioning, asking our IDs, and this has become a routine. We are terrified and we can't even sleep, thinking what would happen to us.
Anti-Rohingya sentiments have risen since the emergence of Hindu nationalist government of BJP in 2014. Since then, many anti-Rohingya campaigns and Hindu groups have been demanding their expulsion, while the government describes them as a security threat. Observers say the Rohingya refugees in particular have in the past and present been used largely for political reasons in this part of the world. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Yemenis have come together before the UN office in Sana'a to call on the international community to step in and pressure the Saudi-led coalition into releasing detained oil vessels. The detention of oil vessels has left the country in desperate struggle to survive amid a harsh shortage of fuel.
We have lots of problems amid fuel shortage. We stay here for days to get some liters of gasoline due to the blockade imposed by the Saudi-led coalition and the continued detention of oil ships. We call on those who are after making concessions against the enemies to stand firm when it comes to the basic needs of Yemeni people.
Major sectors including health have warned that they may collapse in a few days if the detained oil vessels by the Saudi-led coalition are not immediately released. Thousands of facilities have already stopped providing services due to a lack of fuel.
The situation today is entirely catastrophic, especially in the health sector. The petroleum company is unable to provide health facilities with the oil derivatives. 50 days have passed and not even a lease has been allowed to enter the port of Hodeidah. The U.S. and the U.N. bear responsibility of what is happening in Yemen.
The Saudi-led coalition is still holding 14 Yemeni oil ships illegally as they were inspected and authorized by the United Nations through verification and inspection mechanism. Hundreds of cars take days in long lines in front of the only working gas station in Sana'a. Yemenis say overcoming this dire situation needs a real action by the international community to step in and to pressure the Saudi-led coalition to release the detained oil vessels. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
The prosecutor's office against hate crimes in Barcelona says it sees sufficient evidence to investigate Spain's far right for allegedly inciting hatred against Muslims following a complaint by several Muslim communities in Catalonia. At the core of the controversy is a video published online by the nativist ultra-nationalist party Vox during the recent election campaign in Catalonia.
The video falsely claims the entire Muslim community in Catalonia is responsible for the 2017 terrorist attacks in Barcelona. It purportedly shows footage of women in burqas in mosques that was actually shot in Afghanistan and other countries.
Vox's Twitter account was temporarily suspended at the end of January for breaching the company's hate speech regulations with false accusations and unfounded claims against Muslims in Catalonia.
Their strategy is to polarize society, to create fear and manipulate that fear in order to antagonize communities. This is an old mechanism that underlines all forms of racism. It alienates others by labeling them as foreigners. It goes back centuries in the Iberian Peninsula, and that is where you need to start in order to understand the rise of Islamophobia in Spain.
Vox won 11 seats in Catalonia's regional parliament. Their aggressive campaign against Muslims has raised awareness among community leaders to re-examine their alliances.
We regret the silence of political parties in Catalonia in this election. While they all wooed Muslim voters, not a single one had the courage to stand up and denounce the Islamophobic, xenophobic attacks against our country.
Although Catalonia is home to nearly 500,000 Muslims and has elected its first Muslim female member of parliament in 2017, it does not have a central cultural center or great mosque to this day.
Unlike in previous suits against the far right, representatives of the Muslim community in Catalonia say they believe they have a solid case against Vox. They trust the courts will do them justice this time around. Kusai Kadri, Barcelona.
The EU's executive arm, the European Commission, has just launched a new strategy designed to make the 27-nation bloc more assertive when it comes to trade policy. Apparently, the aggressive Trump era highlighted weaknesses in this area. During an online press conference, we asked the commissioner in charge if EU firms will be able to trade with Iran, despite threats of penalties from the US for doing so.
Against the illegal application of third country, illegal extraterritorial application of third country sanctions. For this, we have a blocking statute, which we are looking how to update it.
On Thursday, Charles Michel, who has a mandate to speak on behalf of the EU's 27 government leaders, held a phone conversation with the president of Iran, Hassan Rouhani. A statement issued on behalf of the European Council president says he told Rouhani the EU will continue to deploy efforts to facilitate the full implementation of the Iran nuclear agreement and America's return to the deal. Joe Biden has expressed his willingness to rejoin the 2015 international agreement, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. The point has been made by numerous commentators. This is not about Biden giving indications or keeping promises. It's about the United States respecting international law. After all, the JCPOA is underpinned by a United Nations resolution. So far, however, Biden's administration has failed to take definitive action. The European Investment Bank has told us it will work with Iran once the conditions are right.
It means that, for example, the sanction policy has to be then different, and all the international agreements, you know, that we have to also adhere to, all that has to be sorted out before we can go and be active.
If Washington's illegal sanctions are lifted, Iran will be able to interact more freely with the EU across all industries, including energy.
The more supply there is, the weaker the prices in principle. So Iran being on the market both for oil and gas is good news for the consumers.
The EU is not shy about releasing statements, but it's unclear what concrete steps the bloc, as coordinator of the JCPOA, is taking to pull the US back into line. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
This winter has seen food bank queues snaking around corners in the UK. Those down on their luck waiting up to 5 hours in the freezing cold, not knowing if there will be anything left for them. In places where poverty and hunger were already rife, it's the tip of the iceberg. Jaywick, a seaside village in southeast England, named the country's most deprived area for the past decade. Over the years, local authorities have been grilled over worsening conditions here to no avail. The council declined our request for an interview, but on Facebook, residents themselves were forthcoming. Maria responded to my post, saying her family and neighbours needed food. People here resent their Jaywick's shanty town status and are wary of outsiders. Reporters have tried to get interviews by offering them alcohol in the past. Drug and alcohol abuse are already a problem here. The government has given the local council millions of pounds to build a marketplace and affordable housing, but the locals say they're yet to feel the benefit of that.
They sort the landlords out and they do a bit of housing for people in Jaywick. I know they've built some new houses, but the trouble is the residents of Jaywick are not being offered the new housing.
We're not.
So it is, they're not clearing the crisis really, because there's a lot of people struggling in places with no heating and poor decorating.
These cottages used to be temporary holiday accommodation, but have served as permanent homes for decades now. They are run down and have little or no heating. There is no pressure on property owners to fix them either. Brenda has lived here for 31 years, and with her husband suffering from Alzheimer's, the food bank closing has only added to her woes. Supermarkets say they can't deliver to Jaywick. People are relying on community spirit to get them through. Half the children here live in poverty. Unemployment is high. For every five people, there's only one job. The British government stands accused of leaving it to charities to feed the country's hungry, millions of them children. NGOs say this is a comedown for the fifth largest economy in the world, and food bank queues growing because of the pandemic has only highlighted an already existing crisis. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Following the bitterly disputed 2020 election campaign, top pollster Gallup has found that support for third parties is at its highest point ever in the United States. 62% of people agree that a third party is needed because Democrats and Republicans, quote, do such a poor job representing the American people. Another polling record was also recorded. The number of Americans who identify as an independent is now at 50%.
And everybody's tired of it. Everybody is fed up with the hypocrisy and ineffectiveness of the Democrats in the terms that they claim to want to be effective. I think they're actually very effective in what they're actually doing. And the Republicans, of course, you know, they have one program, which is tax cuts for the rich.
Ex-President Donald Trump, who remains banned from top U.S. social media, issued a rare statement which attacked top Republican leadership. That's being interpreted as a sign that he may stay within the mainstream and try to make so-called Trumpism the undisputed platform of the Republican Party. However, there is much speculation that Trump will start a new third party. Polls say a Trump-led third party would attract not just two-thirds of Republicans, but also 30% of independents and even 15% of Democrats. The party would push Republicans into third place, ushering in a new era of multi-party plurality and ending what is probably the world's oldest political duopoly.
Certainly those people are out there ready for the picking for a third party that they perceive as A, fighting for things that are important to their daily lives, and B, treating them with respect and not treating them as, you know, you're racist and fascist and you know, sexist and whatever.
Trump won in 2016 by running as a so-called outsider candidate, and while he is unemployed 4 years later, rejection of the two mainstream parties is now the majority sentiment. The most popular third parties currently in the U.S. are the Libertarians, who are associated with a strong demand for individualism, the Greens, the Party for Socialism and Liberation, and the Alliance Party, a coalition for independence. Those parties combined for under 2% of the 2020 presidential vote. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
A small shipment of the coronavirus vaccine has finally made it to the Gaza Strip after long delays by the Israeli regime. On Wednesday, the first batch of the Russian Sputnik V vaccines was received by the Ministry of Health in the Gaza Strip. The blockaded enclave has registered close to 54,000 coronavirus infections, mostly since late August 2020. The Israeli regime allowed the entry of the vaccines after coming under heavy criticism by human rights organizations.
Israel, as an occupying power of Palestinian land, bears full responsibility for providing all medical supplies, including inoculations, to combat the coronavirus. We call on all international organizations, including Amnesty International and the World Health Organization, to continue their pressure on Israel to abide by international laws and norms.
Under the Fourth Geneva Convention, the Israeli regime must ensure medical supplies to Palestinians, including combating the spread of pandemics. The enclave's health sector has been battered by the Israeli blockade and multiple wars.
Finally, and after a long delay, the Israeli occupation allowed the transfer of vaccines to the 2 million Palestinians in Gaza. And I think that came as a result of an intervention from UN agencies like WHO and human rights groups.
Despite the increasing number of coronavirus infections in the Gaza Strip, the Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medical equipment.
We have been campaigning on all levels, especially on international agencies, to pressure Israel, who's an occupying power, to bear its legal responsibilities. We have made partial success with the entry of a small shipment of vaccines. We will continue to campaign and expose Israel's actions that have led to the deterioration of the health sector in Gaza, especially during the coronavirus pandemic.
Experts maintain that the Israeli blockade must be fully lifted to help avert a humanitarian disaster.
Human rights groups say Israel's illegal practices have compounded the risk of coronavirus infection for nearly 2 million Palestinians, making it extremely difficult to combat the pandemic. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
The latest available data suggests only 4.8% of EU citizens have so far been vaccinated against COVID-19. Frustration levels are growing because it is not yet clear when people living in the 27-nation bloc can expect to receive the jab.
Of course, everybody needs to speed up. All the countries, France, Belgium, Germany, it's all hanging. We're all hanging around and just waiting.
For example, in France, for my grandparents, it's quite hard to get some appointments to have a dose.
We should speed up a little more and start vaccination a lot. Vaccinate people a lot.
In hindsight, it turned out a bad decision that the EU was responsible because the overall administration is so complex, it would have been easier to have this set up on a national level.
That widely held opinion is being rejected by the head of the European Commission.
With the purchasing power of 27, we were able to agree on this enormous volume I've just described, 2.3 billion doses.
So where are these doses? Experts say the reason the UK and US are way ahead of the EU on vaccination is because the European Commission was too slow to sign contracts with producers, and approval to use the jabs is also a sluggish process.
Mass vaccination centres like this one in Brussels are popping up right across the European Union. On the face of it, that sounds like a great thing. The problem is they are practically empty due to vaccine supply issues.
The European Commission has just launched a plan designed to detect variants of the disease earlier and share this information across the EU. The problem is that mutations are allowed to form when large numbers of people are not vaccinated.
We are ready to go one step further and to propose an emergency authorization of vaccines at EU level with shared liability among us if there's a decision by the European leaders to move in this direction.
The economic consequences for the EU of this slow vaccines rollout are almost immeasurable. The political consequences for the project might prove fatal, according to some analysts. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a televised speech delivered on January 8, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, on the anniversary of an uprising led by the people of the city of Qom on January 9, 1978.
In fact, the 19th of day uprising could be considered as the first Ibrahimi axe blow on the body of the great idol. It was the first axe blow dealt to the great idol called the US by the people of Qom, and more blows were dealt with it later on. Today, you can see in what conditions the US is. Today, you can see the miserable state of the great idol, such as the democracy, such as their electoral debacle, and such as their human rights. On the basis of their human rights, every few hours, or at least every few days, an African-American is murdered on the street without any reason and without having committed any crime, while the murderer is not pursued in any way. Such is the state of their values. They keep speaking about American values, but today they are being ridiculed by the whole world. Even their friends ridicule them. And such is their economy. The US economy is crippled in the true sense of the word. There are tens of millions of unemployed, hungry, and homeless individuals. Such is the condition of the US in present time. This is, of course, an important point.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, my Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger than the good.
Would anyone ignore me? Sayyidul Akwani, huwa al-Mannan. Ali Rabbun Azeemun, laysa li Rabbun siwa, huwa al-Rahman.
But a more surprising point is that some people still point to the US as their Qibla. They continue to pin their hopes and dreams on the US. A US which is in such a condition. Well, we said that the public uprising of the people was anti-American. But the reason was not only that the US president had given his 100% support to the regime. That only served as a release of the people's displeasure and inner rage. Otherwise, it had been 25 years then that the US had exerted all kinds of pressure on the people. With the help of the dictatorial and the corrupt Pahlavi regime, it had turned Iran into its main base, and the result was by no means progress for our country. On the contrary, the result of the US's presence in our country was economic and scientific poverty, corruption, and cultural decadence.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture, everyone. In the first part of the documentary, we met the hidden victims of America's multi-billion dollar chemical industry. By offering an excellent wage and a comfortable retirement package, chemical giants Dow Chemical and DuPont factories are welcome wherever they go. For many of the town's residents, a job at Dow Chemical or DuPont marks the beginning of a very glimmering future. Yet, victims like Alice, Kenton, and Rukna have seen the ugly truth behind this prosperity. Don't go away. Here's the rest of our program.
850 children are now registered at Rashida B's center. In 2015, Dow gave $4.5 billion to its shareholders. But not a single cent has been given to the decontamination of Bhopal. For weeks, we tried to reach the communications department at Dow to get an interview, without success.
Who's going to answer those questions? It's really important.
I'm not aware of who that is right off the top of my head. We have 50,000 employees, so I'll have to do some research.
Dow never called us back. So we decided to go to the company's General Assembly in Midland, in the U.S., to ask our questions. A few days later, we finally received an email from Dow. The company laments, "Bhopal was a terrible tragedy that we will never forget." But they relieved themselves of all responsibility, stating that, "We acquired Union Carbide more than 16 years after the catastrophe of 1984.
Dow continues to address global issues through human solutions. Issues like clean water, as important as life itself. Dow is working to make water safe and readily available to people all over the globe. The human element. Nothing is more fundamental. Nothing more elemental.